as I spoke to you last time as well. With those few words I addressed to your love, I tried to show you that today the church is under attack from every side, and by an organized plan and a systematic method. All of this that you see every day in the newspapers has been carefully engineered. A little at a time, every so often, bit by bit, something new appears. Everything you see and hear is orchestrated. And it is done this way because there is a further aim that has to be achieved. Many are trying to set fire to the walls of the church so that they may break in and plunder her. They want to clear the way. They want to weaken the church so that her voice will no longer be heard, because it is her voice that frightens them. The voice of the church is what prevents them from resting easy. For this reason, they attack the church every day. And last time, in connection with the scandals, we saw how widely the bad press circulates today and what ugly results it produces. The church is not fought only through the press, but also through the so-called skeptics. There are people, let us admit it, in high positions even in the government, who question everything. Today there are scientists who think they know everything and even question the existence of God, and they do not merely question it. They pass their skepticism on to our children as well. A few days ago, I was speaking with some children there, whom I meet regularly, and they told me that their teacher at secondary school had said and had supposedly proved to them that man is descended from the ape. All of this, too, belongs to our times, and it is there for one purpose only, to strike the church without mercy. Man is so foolish that he accepts he comes from the ape, and when you tell him, "You come from God, you were shaped by the hand of God," he does not like that. He likes the other, his descent from the animal. That is how much man today, in a manner of speaking, feeds himself on doubts of this kind. And one more thing before I move on to my subject. Today there is a syncretism. Let me explain this word. Plutarch writes somewhere that in that old time the Cretans, that is, those descended from Crete, those born in Crete, whenever they found themselves facing a common enemy, would unite with one another and march against that enemy, and once the enemy had gone away, they would take up their own quarrels again. To put it more simply, two people may not even speak to each other and may be in dispute over property, but if someone comes along and attacks one of them, the other immediately joins the fight, even to the death. Then, once the enemy is gone, they go back to being enemies with each other. This was observed even back then. I do not know whether it still happens today, and from it came this word, syncretism, which means a union against a single enemy. Today, my brothers, on the question of the church and her property, a union of everyone has been formed. You see it in Parliament, from one end of it to the other, and not one of them disagrees when those laws on abortion and the like are passed. There they are all in agreement, because this so-called syncretism exists. Everyone today is attacking the church. And do you know what all of this is for? So that the church may be stripped bare, so that she may be forced to give ground and not raise her voice, so that here in our Greece the church may not be able to cry out each time some new fashion arrives from abroad. With this mania we have for foreign things, so that the church cannot cry out and say, "No, this will not happen." As happened in the case of John the Baptist, only John raised his voice then to cry out to Herod, "It is not lawful for you. You cannot have your brother's wife." And he was led away to prison, and after that to beheading. That is what they want today, to silence the voice of the church by every possible means. Because the voice of the church is the voice of truth, and the voice of truth does not serve their interests, it does not support their unlawful schemes, nor does it grant them any pardon for their dark designs. And all these attacks are carried out with method, with system, with a plan. Know it, so that you may guard yourselves, and if possible, guard others as well. My subject today is church property. So much noise is being made about it. Every day they write about it, and not only the local newspapers here in Athens, which circulate not only in Greece, but throughout the whole world. Magazines too, and even the local papers. And what they are trying to do is precisely to inform the people about the untold wealth the church holds in her hands. and she keeps it there, they say, and does not give it to the poor. Much is said about this subject, much is written, and much is heard. Yet many people do not know the truth. For this reason I thought it appropriate to depart briefly from the subjects that concern you in this hall, in order to tell you the real truth about what is commonly called church property. And you will see, we will come to it in the end, what malice there is surrounding this whole matter. The newspapers write in huge headlines and let one central idea take hold, that it is the bishops who today enjoy and consume the church's property. Earlier on in a conversation I had with a taxi driver on my way here, that is exactly what he said to me at the end. After I had spoken with him about this and that, and step by step tried to answer all the accusations he holds against the church, his objections extended even to church property. He too has been led to believe that those who hold power in the church today, the clergy, or rather not all the clergy in general, but the bishops, are the ones who appropriate and consume the church's property, and so he believes the state ought finally to intervene, take that property away from the bishops, and give it to poor landless people who have no fields to cultivate in order to provide for their families. And there's something else. Do they not often speak of the church and church property? But right there precisely. The bishops are the ones who manage it all. And something else again, they don't even say, at the very least, let us take the property away from the bishops and hand it to some other church body to hold or administer. No, they say take it from there and give it to the poor and the landless. And so people are left firmly with the idea that our hierarchs, our most reverend bishops, are the ones holding enormous church estates in their hands today, doing whatever they please with them and consuming most of it themselves. With all of this, my brothers, they are aiming at something more. They keep cultivating it, and you will see that they are succeeding. You should know that this whole business of church property began a long time ago, going back a while. Roughly since last year, every so often the newspapers would fire off a few rounds. And lately they have intensified this campaign so much that the state would intervene. And the state did intervene. They prepared the ground. It was like an artillery bombardment against the wall, clearing the way for the assault that would follow. And now the state has come to the church and says, "You will hand this property over to me so that I may take possession of it." But let us look at what this property actually is that the state is now asking to take from the church. Let us see what this property consists of and how much there is, so that you too may have some real knowledge and not have in your minds only what the newspapers write. You need to know that when you hear the words church property, that property is of two kinds: property belonging to the monasteries and property belonging to the parish churches. Both churches and monasteries are legal entities governed by public law. Let me give you an example. One of our fellow Christians dies. Perhaps he was not on good terms with his relatives, or perhaps he simply considered it fitting, or wished to leave whatever material property he possessed in this world, his real estate, to the church, and so he leaves it to a parish church. For example, he leaves his house. That house then becomes the property of the church. The church, however, is administered by a parish council. This council is headed by the priest, who serves as chairman, together with four lay members, who administer and manage this ecclesiastical property. Whether they sell the house to fund the work of the church, or rent it out so that the church receives the rental income from all this property I'm describing now, what we might call the property of the parish church, no one can take anything from a parish church, not the bishop, not anyone else. Do you know who takes from the parish church today? The state? 35% of gross receipts. Yes, indeed. Before we have even covered our expenses, whereas in every business and every shop and factory, the tax office takes its share out of the profits. But here, from the churches, it takes from the gross. That is, out of every 1,000 drachmas, the state takes 350. When they say church property, however, they do not mean the property of the parish churches. They mean the monastic estates, which, it is true, are considerable. So tonight, I'm going to give all of you a bit of a lesson, a history lesson, We will go back a little further and pick things up from the time of the Turkish occupation. You need to know, my brothers, and no one to this day can dispute it, however much the septics may want to dispute or deny it. Under Turkish rule, the only place one could find Greek letters and a living faith was in the monasteries. The monasteries were the refuge of the persecuted. It was to the monasteries that the Rayas, the Christian subjects under Ottoman rule, would flee. It was to the monasteries that young women would flee from the Turks and from the Ottoman yoke, so that they would not be dishonored. Men and women alike would run to these monasteries and find sanctuary there. But even more so the children who went there and learned their first letters in those secret Greek schools. With the secret school, with the monk sitting there by the oil lamp, with the vigil lamp and the psalter and the other church books, the monks labored to preserve our Greek language and the faith in Christ, and so it has been preserved to this day. The Greeks ran to those monasteries in gratitude. They took refuge there, and many of them, yes, let us admit it, left their property behind. They left their property to the monasteries so that it would be safe there. And it truly was safe, because even the conquerors respected the monasteries. Harsh as that Turkish occupation was, brutal as it was, nevertheless, through the firmans the monasteries managed to obtain, and through the various gifts they sent this way and that, they managed not only to preserve their property, but also to allow the Greek soul, the Greek ideal, and faith in Christ and orthodoxy to be born and reborn there. Out of gratitude, then, most of these people left their estates to the monasteries, so much property to one monastery, so much to another, and so on. And it was precisely to these monasteries that our forefathers, the Armatoloi and the Klepts, would take refuge. After striking the enemy, they would make their way to the monasteries, to those very monasteries. From there came the bullets. From there they drew their supplies, and they carried them everywhere. Many of you who have been to Agia Lavra and to the Megas Belial, I don't know if you picked up those books and read the historical documents kept there, where each war chief would write, "Send me this much," he would say to the monk. "Send me this much," he would say to the abbot, and the abbot sent it. And there were many occasions when even holy gospel books and chalices were sold, for no other reason than to strengthen the struggle against the Turks. And so in 1821, the monasteries became the staging grounds of the Armatoloi and the Klepts. The staging grounds, the place from which they received both the blessing of God and Greek reinforcements, so that they could run out and fight and set our Greek homeland free. So the monks offered up the sacred vessels and the treasures again and again, and not only these lifeless things, but living men as well. How many monks? How many brothers of the monasteries? How many archimandrites are there on the column of heroes with their names inscribed, who fell for faith and for country? The sacrifices of the monasteries were truly many, my brothers, and one day, the blessed day of our independence arrived. The blessed day of freedom arrived, and then everyone hastened to begin the work of reorganization. After a war and liberation, the state is naturally always in disarray, and the rulers and others make every effort to organize it anew. At that time, there was disorder in the church as well. The church, too, began to regroup its forces. It began to expand, because there were no churches. The churches themselves were small and low, built that way under the Turks, and under slavery. Little by little, though, they began to be staffed again, so that they could be raised up and take back into their own hands the reorganization of the church and begin their spiritual work. In 1833, 12 years after the war began, after the struggle for liberation began, the laws of the state concerning the church arrived, and that is when the ingratitude began, my brothers. Yes, within those few years the ingratitude of the Greek state began. Because at that time, you should know, regents had come here, Bavarians. 3 regents came here to organize the affairs of the state, because the king, the first king of Greece, was still a minor. Among them was Maurer, the man who drafted the ecclesiastical laws. He was a Protestant and a German, and he knew nothing at all about orthodoxy. This man did not understand what the Orthodox Church of the East meant, because Orthodoxy had been under bondage for so many years and was not visible. And it was nowhere to be seen. At that time, the historian tells us, there were 512 monasteries in Greece, and with the law that was passed, 415 of them were shut down. The law said that any monastery with fewer than 6 monks would be closed and its property would pass to the state. That was the first seizure. That was the ingratitude of the Greek state towards the struggles and the sacrifices of the monasteries and the monastic communities. Indeed, if you go to the countries behind the Iron Curtain, if you go just next door to Bulgaria, you will see how much the Bulgarians who are atheists, who do not believe, respect the church. And only a few days ago, a metropolitan who had gone there as a visitor was telling me about it. The minister said to him, "Ah," he said, "we respect our church, because to her we owe our independence and our learning. Never mind that we do not believe in God, we respect her," he said, "and we defend her." Do Greeks say that today? And that was not all. What else? Every young monk under 25 years of age, the law of the state said he had to take off the cassock and go back home. All this was done with the authority of the state leading the way. The Bavarians did not know what monasticism means. They did not know what vows monks make at their tonsure. They knew none of this. They were Protestants, and they issued an order like that. Imagine what happened in those days with young monks weeping. They wept at being torn away from their monasteries. How far this really went, and what a betrayal of the sacrifices of the monks who had fought. And so the state took the property of 415 monasteries. It took the lion's share. And did it give it to the landless? Did it give it to poor laborers struggling to live? Our own people took it, as unfortunately happens every single time here in Greece. And then one more year on, in 1834, another law is issued. That quickly, already. And it closed every women's monastery. These convents we visit now, that you see, where there are nuns and where things have been reorganized somewhat, we venerate our holy things there, and often we find refuge there, escaping from this Babylon here to go and breathe a little oxygen. These are newly established monasteries, founded only in recent times. Previously, they had been men's monasteries because all the women's monasteries were closed in 1834. At that time, the state allowed only 3 monasteries to become women's monasteries, one in the Peloponnese, one on the islands, and one in central Greece. That is how far our state went in those days. And then another order, even more terrible. Nuns under 40 years of age had to be stripped of the monastic habit to have the schema taken from them and go back to their homes. Then there was weeping and lamentation. State officials put the nuns out of the monastery, outside the gate, and they sat there. They did not want to leave. "Let us go back into our monastery," they said. "Let us go back into our house of repentance." Nothing. The state men were unyielding again. The officers of the law kept them outside, and they stayed out there for days and nights on end, weeping, refusing to go back to their homes. None of what I'm telling you is my own. It is all recorded. Konstantinos Oikonomos ex Oikonomon wrote about it, and if you wish, you can find his books and read them. All the property belonging to all the women's monasteries was taken and handed over to the state, and there is something else, something truly unheard of. When one reads it, one is deeply moved and sheds many tears, for it shows just how mercilessly and ungratefully the Greek state acted. The Greek state has behaved ungratefully towards the monasteries and towards the church in general. A law was issued at that time saying that the immovable property of the monasteries would pass to the state, and not only the immovable property, but the movable goods as well. And that is when the plundering came. That is when the acts of sacrilege came. The officials came in, state officials, tax men. They walked into the monasteries. They walked into the Catholica, the main churches of the monasteries. They walked into the sanctuaries themselves, and they took the chalices and patens, the gospel books, everything, like latter-day Turks. They seized all of it, put it into sacks, called the porters, carried it off, and took it to the markets to sell it. and then we are told our Christians would run and buy these things back from the markets. There was a public auction, they paid money, they sold their own property in order to get back the gospel books and the chalices and the holy icons, and keep them safe so as to hand them over again when the monastery was restored. And we have evidence of this even today. There are icons in monasteries that had been plundered back then, icons that were taken to market and sold. They were bought back, and they returned once more to the monasteries. These are precisely the kind of unholy deeds, my brothers and sisters, that were committed in those days by the newly established Greek state. They fell upon them like wolves, the historian writes there, like ravening wolves, snatching whatever they found, plundering it, as though they were not members of the church themselves, as though they were not Orthodox Christians, but no, they were the authorities, they were the power of the state. That was the conduct, that was the behavior the Greek state showed toward the sacrifices of the monasteries and of the church in general, and all of that was not enough. Then came 1835, when the seat of the Greek state was moved from Nafplio here to Athens. Every building that housed the state services belonged to the church. They took them, and not only did they take them, they even turned sacred places into stables for the horses. The military horses are also mentioned, the sacred places, it says, were turned into stables for the army's animals. Even so, they allowed about 100 monasteries to survive. These monasteries possessed considerable property which the monks worked and made productive to meet the needs of the monastery and to support their missionary work, a mission they have never ceased carrying out to this day. But then in 1920, another law was enacted, and then another law. It provided for compulsory expropriations. Do you know what a compulsory expropriation means? When a piece of land or some other property, a building, is judged to be needed for something of public benefit, then it is expropriated. Certain procedures are followed, and if you have a house there, you have to move out, because a school is going to be built or a road is going to pass through, or that road will cut your land in two, or they will take all of it for some project, the way it happens today with the electricity company and so on. This compulsory expropriation is supposed to involve compensation, not what the plot or the house is actually worth, but roughly whatever the presiding official decides. That is what this law of 1920 said, and so it seized a great deal of church property in order to hand it out to landless farmers. But no, that property was never handed out, because the party bosses took it, and the various friends of the members of parliament, so that they would have votes, and something else outrageous happened as well. To this day, the church has never been compensated, even though the expropriation was compulsory and carried out by law. Yet at the time of the Asia Minor catastrophe, the church, entirely on her own initiative, showed real generosity. She gave away a great many of her lands for the sake of the landless people who came from Asia Minor, and not only here in Attica, but throughout the whole of Greece. But that was never written down anywhere. No one even noticed it. No one has ever praised it. Right up to today, the Organization for the Management of Church Property, this organization took over all the property of the monasteries, the part that could be liquidated in order to develop it, manage it, and administer it for the benefit of the church. This organization still exists today, and it has produced a great many good results. But it is not administered by clergy alone. Because when I say church, I mean clergy and people together. Pay attention, because nowadays people confuse the word. When many people say church, they mean the clergy. The clergy, no. When we say that, it is heresy. The church is the clergy and the laity together. It is not administered solely by the clergy. The archbishop serving at the time is the chairman. Two bishops are members, and there are four lay members, senior civil servants or bank directors. In other words, it is a seven-member council, and the clergy do not even hold the majority, if you will. The laity do. The church. There are four of them, and the clergy are only three. These are the men who manage all this property which to this day is called liquidatable property, A great deal of it has been sold, and buildings have been put up that bring in an income, and out of that income all the preachers who serve throughout Greece are paid. In 1952, an agreement was made with the state. The state said, "Give us part of this property of the monasteries, and we will give you urban real estate in return." What they want to do all over again now was already done back in 1952. It is true that this arrangement was to the church's advantage, because the largest part of that property I'm speaking of, the liquidatable part, is forest. It is forest land, and today it costs the church money. For example, the monasteries have by now given this organization ODEP 1 million stremmata, but it is forest. Now pay attention to this. These forests, instead of bringing in a profit, are actually a loss for ODEP. Why? Because by a decision of the minister and by a provision of the constitution, it is forbidden to sell forest land. Even a single tree, a single pine you may have in your own yard, you cannot cut down without permission from the Ministry of Agriculture. And so this property, which is supposed to be liquidatable, immediately becomes property that must be preserved. But it does have timber, and the wood has to be cut. There are forest guards, and there are the so-called forestry experts. They are the ones who have to select the trees to be felled, so that the timber can be cut and sent to market. Now pay attention to the figures I am about to give you, which I have taken from the Holy Synod, so that you can see how matters really stand. The salaries of these employees who are paid by ODEP amount to 10 million a year. Yet the church, that is ODEP, receives only 2 million a year from the timber it sells, so ODEP suffers a loss of 8 million annually. These facts are on record, but the newspapers do not report them. So they say to the state, "We are giving you this land, take it." But the state says, "No, we want the rest of the monastery's property too," they say. That is what the state will be saying about these things today, my brothers. Even so, in 1952, the state did in fact take a considerable amount of land. I do not have many figures to give you, but here are a few by way of example. In Attica, the church gave 140,000 stremmata, and in exchange received only 43,000. In Thessaly, she gave 183,000 stremmata, and in exchange received only 8,000. In Macedonia, 69,000 stremmata, and in return it received only 400 stremmata. That is the kind of consistency the Greek state showed. In other words, in 1952 the state took 613,000 stremmata and gave the church only 57,000 stremmata to make use of. And so we come to our own day. After the newspapers had worked all this up about church property, and after the papers that supposedly loved the church had shouted, "Just take the property, hand it over to the state, and let the state give it to the landless." And it reached the point, once all this had been cultivated, where the state says, "You will hand over the property, and let us come to an agreement." And a kind of preliminary agreement was reached between church and state. The church would give up 4/5 of all this property, both ODEP ED UPT and the monasteries, and only 1/5 would remain with the church, with the difference, though, that the church would be free to develop that fifth. But can anyone place their trust in this, after all the instability and all the broken promises right up to today? Let me give you an example, and a recent one at that. In the years of the revolution, when Ari Hieronymos was in office, the following plan was made. They said, "We still have a few stremmata at Vouliagmeni, which the orphanage occupies today." The experts said it would be advantageous to convert the orphanage into a hotel complex. It would generate such a large profit that, instead of caring for the 50 orphan children we have there today, we could care for 1,000, and indeed the plans were drawn up. The children were moved from Vouliagmeni to a rented building in Ekali, for which they paid 50,000 a month in rent. This went on for 3 full years. Once the plans had been drawn up, the engineers said that we needed to obtain the building regulations. "Who will issue them?" they asked. "The Ministry of Public Works," came the reply. After studying the matter for several months, the Ministry of Public Works said, "No, the tourism authorities are responsible, and each one passed it off onto the other. This matter was held up for 3 whole years. Then one evening, and this is to his credit, a senior state official came forward and warned the church, "Take the children back into the orphanage," he said, "because otherwise they will take this property from you and turn it into hotels of their own." And indeed, they set to work quickly and moved the orphans. They brought them back in without even having repaired the buildings first, and the repairs were done with the orphans already inside. The buildings were repaired so that they could be used again, so that the orphanage could move back in and be housed where it stands to this day. My brothers, if you knew what land grabs have taken place with this so-called church property, you would be horrified. Men at the very top, of high standing and holding high office, have again and again taken over plots of land. They even sent in associations which encroached on whole tracts. And when, at one point, the archbishopric was in a position to reach a settlement concerning a claim it had against the monastery of Penteli, it asked for a parcel of land to be given to the clergy or their families, even if it were by the sea, since all that land belonged to the church. Today, however, it no longer does, and to this day the church has not been compensated. Then they say a parcel was found somewhere beyond the mountains of Dao Penteli. I remember that they once took the priests there. I did not go personally to show them an area down in some ravines. That was what remained for them to offer as building plots to the priests, so they could house their families there during the summer. And yet, even there, the church is losing money today. On the one hand, they will not allow even the plots that are left to be developed. They do not set building conditions. On the other hand, along comes the municipality of Vuliagmeni, and the municipality of Glyfada, and the municipality of Vula, and they say, "Now pay us for the undeveloped land." And in 1 year the church paid 4 whole million. But everything I'm telling you is known to everyone, and the journalists know it too. They simply do not publish it, because they want the people to be fed on what they themselves write. That way they can mislead not only the atheists and the objectors, but they also try to scandalize us as well. And many times we Christians reach the point of saying, "Look what Bishop so-and-so eats. Look what the priests and the bishops are eating." All of this is lies. It is done only to create incidents, only to stir the people up for something else they have in mind, something that will break out at some later point and will be bad both for our state and for our church. So today we find ourselves in this situation, and the state is trying to enter into negotiations with the church, and then this grave error was committed, an action so lawless, illegal, and unconstitutional. The Minister of Religious Affairs and National Education introduced a law declaring that the property of the church was to be frozen. Churches and monasteries are to be prohibited from buying or selling property, something that does not apply to anyone else. For today the church is not the only one that owns such property. Others do as well. Why then are no restrictions imposed on them? Why is there one standard for them and another for the church? But it is the church that is to be weakened. It is the church that is to be left with no resources at all. Let me give you one telling example. Take the church calendar and see how many charitable institutions the metropolises maintain. These are not the old days. That time is gone, my dear ones. Today we live in such well-lit days, and today everything is laid out openly. These are not the old years when we hid this and that. Today everyone works with their cards on the table. Pick up the church calendar and look at the institutions. Do you know what boarding houses the metropolises maintain if you go up into Macedonia, to the right and to the left? Children leave the provinces, and instead of ending up in houses of ill repute, and I do not know where else, staying somewhere so they can go to school and get an education, they go to the buildings and boarding houses of the church. And do you think they pay there? They give symbolic amounts, 500 or 600 drachmas. Do you know what an institution costs today? I have in mind an institution of ours in Pangrati that has only 28 children, and it costs 100,000 a month. All that money is found from the surplus of the monastic property. The nuns and the monks work there with their handicrafts. and when they hand over what they earn to the metropolis, they hand over a reserve fund, and then the Metropolitan Council says, this will go to that institution, this to another one's institution, this to another's, and this to another's. And now the state wants to cut all of this off. The state's sole aim is to weaken the church so that she can do nothing. On one side there is this, on another the scandals, and on yet another her property. The purpose is not only to silence the church, but also to reduce her to beggary, so that she must go running to the state and plead, give me the money to build this, give me the money to build that. And when someone has to ask another for help, he later has to make concessions as well. But the church will never make concessions. Let us now turn to another matter, which also absolutely must be clarified. They want to blame everything on the bishops. They are the ones who supposedly pocket it all. You know, this whole business has reached such proportions that one often does not know whether to laugh or cry, because such unbelievable things are written that one cannot help smiling. Yet there are also people who are scandalized by them. I even have a recent newspaper here. Listen to what it says. It has a whole lengthy tirade against the hierarchs, and at one point it says, most metropolitans turn their riches into securities so that they cannot be traced by the Christians. Something like that might have happened in the old years. Today, my brothers and sisters, our metropolitans work, and their work is plain to see. All of you know them especially well yourselves. He goes on and says, not only does he believe these things, but do you know what he does on top of that? He even takes down the icon he keeps in his car. These are the results of the newspapers of our time. And now let me tell you something that even you do not know. They say that every metropolitan who has a small metropolis tries to move to a bigger one so that he can take in more. That is a mistake, a great lie, and a deception. Today the metropolitan, and I am in a position to assure you of this from this podium. They, of course, receive only a salary. That salary is indeed a decent one, and nothing more, not a single drachma beyond it. When we go to pay for a marriage license, all the money collected goes towards social insurance stamps and revenue stamps. The metropolitan does not receive a single drachma. I am in a position to know this, indeed. In the metropolis where I serve, he never takes anything even from fees for services. The Annunciation. Every now and then they'll call him to serve at a funeral, and he hasn't taken a single drachma for it to this day. If somebody does insist on giving something, there is what's called the Church Action Fund, the Diocesan Fund for Church Work, and the person goes and pays it in there and gets a receipt. And that fund has its own board and all the rest of it for the missionary work of the diocese. A metropolitan serving today on Kythera and a metropolitan serving today in Piraeus draw exactly the same salary. One of them may get a little more if he has more years of service as a preacher behind him, because those years are counted. That is the salary he has, and it is indeed fairly large, but he also has to cover his own expenses himself. He himself has to hire someone to cook for him, someone to look after his room, wherever it is that he will stay. He must also provide the meals himself, because each time visitors, sometimes many, sometimes fewer, turn to him. The public prosecutor will go to the metropolitan. The traveling official will go to the metropolitan. Mr. A will go to the metropolitan. And so will Mr. B, a government employee. And the metropolitan will receive them as guests, and the hospitality will be worthy of Abraham, all of it out of his salary. But let me tell you something else as well. Our God will not judge us for how much money we made as long as we made it honestly. He will judge us for what we did with it. A man who takes 1,000 drachmas a month can be condemned, and a man who takes 100,000 drachmas a month can be condemned, because, keep this in mind, Abraham too in the Old Testament was no ordinary man. From a material point of view he was exceedingly rich, the richest man of his age, and yet he has won the prize. He is in paradise. His riches did not stop him from reaching that place. I say this so that we will not be quick to condemn. So if there are properties today, those properties do not belong to the hierarchs, nor do they belong to the metropolitans. They belong to the metropolises, to the monasteries. In the same way, we can say that there is property which belongs to the municipality, to the town hall. But it is not the mayor's property. And in the same way, property that belongs to the metropolis or to a holy monastery is not the metropolitan's. Still, to be fair, sometimes there may be grounds for criticism. It can happen, I don't deny it, that someone is handed a bit of money on the side and takes it, even if he is a hierarch, and puts it in his own pocket. That is another matter altogether, but it is the exception. We cannot take that exception and generalize it and say that they are all like that. I am in a position to assure you that there are hierarchs today who struggle from morning until night, and who are very sparing with themselves in what they eat, and how they move about in everything. In one thing only are they generous, in charity, and not so much for material poverty as for spiritual poverty, for printed material, for the written word. I remember once the Metropolitan got up out of bed with a fever to go and preach at the vespers of a feast day, and the doctor said to him, "Your Eminence, please have some pity on yourself. You don't belong to yourself." And he answered, "That is exactly why. Precisely because I don't belong to myself, I have to go and speak tonight." But these things, my brothers and sisters, do not get written up in the newspapers. I myself personally took a letter to the newspaper that answered them point for point, and the newspaper would not print it, the journalist would not print it. And not only that, I went to other newspapers as well and lodged a protest. And I said, "He won't print this reply? I will pay you. You print it." And they said, "Father, journalistic ethics do not permit us. Do you understand? So how are we supposed to see the truth? Where are we expecting to find the truth from the newspapers?" My brothers and sisters, perhaps I am tiring you with all this, but I want you to know that this is the reality. So be careful in what you say, and above all in how you behave. There are many newspapers, but there is one in particular that got into a great many homes by dishonest means. There is one newspaper that came in presenting itself as independent, and it got into every home. It circulates in everyone's pocket. And yet from the very beginning it had one purpose, and one only, to bring the church down. It is the newspaper that ended up defending whom? The Chileasts, the Jehovah's Witnesses. The bishops, it says, don't look after their own affairs. What concerns them now is abortion and the legalization of adultery. Look at where we have come to. If there is something rotten among all of us who serve, if there are 10 or 20, as I said the other time, who are unworthy even to wear the cassock, then they most certainly must go. But on the second point, let me say this. That is what bothered them. That alone is what bothered them. And for that is the church supposed to grant an amnesty to evil. Is she supposed to pardon the man who comes and walks into someone's home and breaks up a family? My beloved, that is not how it is. The church will stand, but she will only stand if all of us hold her up. The clergy and the laity alike, all of us who are active, living members of our church. We have to close ranks and draw together, and do you know where that gathering has to happen? At the holy altar, the sacred table of sacrifice. That is where we will all be drawn together, and that is where we will draw our strength from. We will not fight on our own, because every time we have fought on our own, we have fallen flat on our faces. We will fight only when we are strengthened from the altar of sacrifice. You are blessed people because from this pulpit you have been taught many truths, sound things, you have taken up good positions. But be careful that you keep standing there. Be joined to one another around the altar of sacrifice, clergy and people together. Only then will we be able to raise our voice as the church has always raised it, and to say no to evil, no to those who want to plunder our holy things and all that we hold sacred.